Chapter 12. As I dressed in front of the mirror that night, I suffered the hard-edged conviction that someone else was wearing my sleeve, and that I had been reduced to the role of a passenger in the observation car behind the eyes. Psycho-entirety rejection, they call it. Or just fragmenting. It's not unusual to get some tremors, even when you're an experienced sleeve changer, but this was the worst case I'd had for years. For long moments, I was literally terrified to have a detailed thought, in case the man in the mirror noticed my presence. Frozen, I watched him adjust the Tevet knife in its neurospring sheath, pick up the Nemex and the Phillips gun one by one, and check the load of each weapon. The slug guns had both come equipped with cheap fiber grip holsters that enzyme bonded to clothing wherever they were pressed. The man in the mirror settled the Nemex under his left arm, where it would be hidden by his jacket, and stowed the Phillips gun in the small of his back. He practiced snatching the guns from their holsters a couple of times, throwing them out at his reflection, but there was no need. The virtual practice discs had lived up to Clive's promises. He was ready to kill someone with either weapon. I shifted behind his eyes. Reluctantly, he stripped off the guns and the knife and laid them once more on the bed. Then he stood for a while, until the unreasonable feeling of nakedness had passed. The weakness of weapons, Virginia Vidara had called it, and from day one in envoy training it was considered a cardinal sin to fall into it. A weapon, any weapon, is a tool, she told us. Cradled in her arms was a sunjet particle gun, designed for a specific purpose, just as any tool is, and only useful in that purpose. You would think a man a fool to carry a force hammer with him everywhere simply because he's an engineer. And as it is with engineers, so it is doubly with envoys. In the ranks, Jimmy DeSoto coughed his amusement. At the time, he was speaking for most of us. 90% of envoy intake came up through the Protectorate's conventional forces, where weaponry generally held a status somewhere between that of toy and personal fetish. UN Marines went everywhere armed, even on furlough. Virginia Vidara heard the cough and caught Jimmy's eye.
"Mr. DeSoto, you do not agree."
Jimmy shifted, a little abashed at how easily he had been picked out.
"Well, ma'am, my experience has been that the more punch you carry, the better account you give of yourself."
There was a faint ripple of assent through the ranks. Virginia Vidara waited until it subsided.
"Indeed," she said, and held out the particle thrower in both hands. "This device punches somewhat. Please come here and take it."
Jimmy hesitated a little, but then pushed his way to the front and took the weapon. Virginia Vidara fell back so that Jimmy was center stage before the assembled trainees, and stripped off her corps jacket. In the sleeveless coveralls and space deck slippers, she looked slim and very vulnerable.
"You will see," she said loudly, "that the charge setting is at test. If you hit me, it will result in a small first-degree burn, nothing more. I am at a distance of approximately 5 meters. I am unarmed. Mr. DeSoto, would you care to attempt to mark me? On your call."
Jimmy looked startled, but he duly brought the sunjet up to check the setting, then lowered it and looked at the woman opposite him.
"On your call," she repeated.
"Now," he snapped.
It was almost impossible to follow. Jimmy was swinging the sunjet as the word left his mouth, and in approved firefight fashion, he cut the charge loose before the barrel even reached the vertical. The air filled with the particle thrower's characteristic angry crackle. The beam licked out. Virginia Vidara was not there. Somehow, she had judged the angle of the beam to perfection and ducked away from it. Somehow else, she had closed the 5-meter gap by half, and the jacket in her right hand was in motion. It wrapped around the barrel of the sunjet and jerked the weapon aside. She was on Jimmy before he realized what had happened, batting the particle thrower away across the training room floor, tripping and tumbling him, and bringing the heel of one palm gently to rest under his nose. The moment stretched and then broke as the man next to me pursed his lips and blew out a long, low whistle. Virginia Vidara bowed her head slightly in the direction of the sound, then bounced to her feet and helped Jimmy up.
"A weapon is a tool," she repeated, a little breathlessly. "A tool for killing and destroying. There will be times when, as an envoy, you must kill and destroy. Then you will choose and equip yourself with the tools that you need, but remember the weakness of weapons. They are an extension. You are the killer and destroyer. You are whole, with or without them."
Shrugging his way into the Intuit jacket, he met his own eyes in the mirror once more. The face he saw looking back was no more expressive than the mandroid at Larkin and Green. He stared impassively at it for a moment, then lifted one hand to rub at the scar under the left eye. A final glance up and down, and I left the room, with the sudden cold resurgence of control flooding through my nerves. Riding down in the elevator, away from the mirror, I forced a grin. "Got the frags, Virginia." "Breathe," she said. "Move. Control." And we went into the street. The Hendricks offered me a courteous good evening as I stepped through the main doors, and across the street my tail emerged from a tea house and drifted along parallel to me. I walked for a couple of blocks, getting the feel of the evening and wondering whether to lose him. The half-hearted sunlight had persisted for most of the day, and the sky was more or less unclouded, but it still wasn't warm. According to a map I'd called up from the Hendricks, Licktown was a good dozen and a half blocks south. I paused on a corner, signaled an auto cab down from the prowl lane above, and saw my tail doing the same as I climbed aboard. He was beginning to annoy me. The cab curved away southward. I leaned forward and passed a hand over the visitor's blurb panel.
"Welcome to Irvine Services," a smooth female voice said. "You are linked to the Irvine Central Data Stack. Please state the information you require."
"Are there any unsafe areas in Licktown?"
"The zone designated Licktown is generally considered to be unsafe in its entirety," the data stack said blandly. "However, Irvine Services guarantees carriage to any destination within the Bay City limits and..."
"Yeah. Can you give me a street reference for the highest incidence of violent criminality in the Licktown area?" There was a brief pause while the data head went down rarely used channels.
19th Street, the blocks between Missouri and Wisconsin, show 53 incidents of organic damage over the last year. 177 prohibited substance arrests, 122 with incidents of minor organic damage, 200...
"That's fine. How far is it from Jerry's closed quarters, Mariposa and San Bruno?"
"Straight line distance is approximately 1 kilometer.
"Got a map?"
The console lit up with a street grid, complete with location crosshairs for Jerry's and the names of the streets fired in green. I studied it for a couple of moments.
"All right, drop me there, 19th and Missouri."
"As part of our customer charter, it is my duty to warn you that this is not an advisable destination."
I sat back and felt the grin creeping back onto my face, unforced this time. "Thanks." The cab set me down without further protest at the cross of 19th and Missouri. I glanced around as I climbed out and grinned again. Inadvisable destination had been a typical machine understatement. Where the streets I'd chased the Mongol through the night before were deserted, this part of Licktown was alive, and its inhabitants made Jerry's clientele look almost salubrious. As I paid off the auto cab, a dozen heads swiveled to focus on me. None of them wholly human. I could almost feel mechanical photomultiplier eyes ratcheting in from a distance on the currency I'd chosen to pay with, seeing the notes in ghostly, luminescent green, canine-augmented nostrils twitching with the scent of my hotel bath gel, the whole crowd picking up the blip of wealth on their street sonar, like the trace of a bottleneck shoal on a Millsport skipper's screen. The second cab was spiraling down behind me. An unlit alley beckoned, less than a dozen meters away. I'd barely stepped into it when the first of the locals made their play.
"You looking for something, tourist?"
There were three of them, the lead vocalist, a 2.5-meter giant, naked to the waist, with what looked like Nakamura's entire muscle-graft sails for the year wrapped around his arms and trunk. There were red aluminum tattoos under the skin of his pectorals, so his chest looked like a dying coal fire, and a glands-headed cobra reared up the rigid muscles of his stomach from his waistline. The hands that hung open at his sides were tipped with filed talons. His face was seamed with scar tissue from the freak fights he had lost, and there was a cheap prosthetic magna lens screwed into one eye. His voice was surprisingly soft and sad-sounding.
"Come, slumming, maybe,"
the figure on the giant's right said viciously. He was young and slim and pale, with long, fine hair falling across his face, and there was a twitchiness about his stance that said cheap neurochem. He would be the fastest. The third member of the welcoming committee said nothing, but lips peeled back from a canine snout to show transplanted predator teeth and an unpleasantly long tongue. Below the surgically augmented head, the body was male human beneath tightly strapped leather. Time was shortening. My tail would be paying off his cab, getting his bearings, if he decided to take the risk. I cleared my throat.
"I'm just passing through. You're wise, you'll let me. There's a citizen landing back there you'll find easier to take."
There was a brief, disbelieving pause. Then the giant reached for me. I brushed away his hand, fell back a step, and wove a rapid pattern of obvious killing strikes into the air between us. The trio froze, the canine augments snarling. I drew breath. "Like I said, you're wise. You'll let me pass." The giant was ready to let it go. I could see it in his broken face. He'd been a fighter long enough to spot combat training, and his instincts of a lifetime in the ring told him when the balance was tipped. His two companions were younger and knew less about losing. Before he could say anything, the pale kid with the neurochem lashed out with something sharp, and the augment went for my right arm. My own neurochem, already ticking over and probably more pricey, was faster. I took the kid's arm and broke it at the elbow, twisting him around on his own pain and into his two companions. The augment ducked around him, and I kicked out, connecting hard with nose and mouth. A yelp, and he went down. The kid dropped to his knees, keening and nursing his shattered elbow. The giant surged forward and fetched up with the stiffened fingers of my right hand a centimeter from his eyes. "Don't," I said quietly. The kid moaned on the ground at our feet. Behind him, the canine augment lay where the kick had thrown him, twitching feebly. The giant crouched between them, big hands reaching as if to comfort. He looked up at me, mute accusation for something in his face. I backed away down the alley about a dozen meters, then turned and sprinted. Let my tail work his way through that and catch me up. The alley made a right-angle turn before spilling out onto another crowded street. I turned the corner and let my speed run down so that I emerged into the street at a fast walk. Turning left, I shouldered my way into the midst of the crowd and started looking for street signs. Outside Jerry's, the woman was still dancing, imprisoned in the cocktail glass. The club sign was alight, and business seemed, if anything, to be brisker than the previous night. Small knots of people came and went beneath the flexing arms of the door robot, and the dealers I'd injured during the fight with the Mongol had been replaced several times over. I crossed the street and stood before the robot while it patted me down, and the synth voice said,
"Clear. Do you want cabins or bar?"
"What's the deal in the bar?"
"Ho, ho, ho,"
went the laugh protocol.
"The bar is look, but don't touch. No money down, no hands on. House rule. That applies to other customers, too."
"Cabins."
"Down the stairs, to the left. Take a towel from the pile."
Down the stairs, along the corridor lit in rotating red, past the towel alcove and the first four closed cabin doors. Blood-deep thunder of the junk rhythm in the air. I closed the fifth door behind me, fed a few notes to the credit console for appearance's sake, and stepped up to the frosted glass screen. Louise? The curves of her body thudded against the glass, breasts flattened. The cherry light in the cabin flung stripes of light across her.
Louise, it's me, Irene, Lizzie's mother.
A smear of something dark between the breasts across the glass. The Nurikam leapt alive inside me. Then the glass door hinged open and the girl's body sagged off its inner surface into my arms. A wide-muzzled gun appeared over her shoulder, pointed at my head.
"Right there, fucker!" a tight voice said. "This is a toaster. You do one wrong thing, it'll take your head off your chest and turn your stack to solder."
I froze. There was an urgency in the voice that wasn't far-off panic. Very dangerous.
"That's it."
The door behind me opened, gusting the pulse of the music in the corridor, and a second gun muzzle jammed into my back.
"Now you put her down, real slow, and stand back."
I lowered the body in my arms gently onto the satin-padded floor and stood up again. Bright white lights sprang up in the cabin, and the revolving cherry blinked pinkly twice and went out. The door behind me thudded shut on the music, while before me a tall blonde man in close-fitting black advanced into the room, knuckles whitened on the trigger of his particle blaster. His mouth was compressed, and the whites of his eyes were flaring around stimulant-blasted pupils. The gun in my back bore me forward, and the blonde kept coming until the muzzle of the blaster was smearing my lower lip against my teeth.
"Now, who the fuck are you?" he hissed at me.
I turned my head aside far enough to open my mouth. "Irene Elliott. My daughter used to work here." The blonde stepped forward, gun muzzle tracing a line down my cheek and under my chin.
"You're lying to me," he said softly. "I've got a friend out at the Bay City Justice Facility, and he tells me Irene Elliott's still on stack. See, we checked out the bag of shit you sold this cunt."
He kicked at the inert body on the floor, and I peered down out of the corner of my nearest eye. In the harsh white light, the marks of torture were livid on the girl's flesh.
"Now, I want you to think real carefully about your next answer, whoever you are. Why are you asking after Lizzie Elliott?"
I slid my eyes back over the barrel of the blaster to the clenched face beyond. It wasn't the expression of someone who'd been dealt in. Too scared.
"Lizzie Elliott's my daughter, you piece of shit, and if your friend up at the city store had any real access, you'd know why the record says I'm still on stack."
The gun in my back shoved forward more sharply, but unexpectedly, the blonde seemed to relax. His mouth flexed in a rictus of resignation. He lowered the blaster.
"All right," he said. "Deke, go and get Octai."
Someone at my back slipped out of the cabin. The blonde waved his gun at me.
"You,
sit down in the corner." His tone was distracted, almost casual. I felt the gun taken out of my back and moved to obey. As I settled onto the satin floor, I weighed the odds. With Deke gone, there were still three of them. The blonde, a woman in what looked to me like a synthetic Asian skin sleeve, toting the second particle blaster whose imprint I could still feel in my spine, and a large black man whose only weapon appeared to be an iron pipe. Not a chance. These were not the street sharks I'd faced down on 19th Street. There was a cold, embodied purpose about them, a kind of cheap version of what Cadman had had back at the Hendrix. For a moment, I looked at the synthetic woman and wondered, but it couldn't be. Even if he'd somehow managed to slip the charges Kristen Ortega had talked about and got himself re-sleeved, Cadman was on the inside. He knew who had hired him, and who I was. The faces peering at me from around the bio-cabin, on their own admission, knew nothing.
Let's keep it that way.
My gaze crept across to Louise's battered sleeve. It looked as if they had cut slits in the skin of her thighs and then forced the wounds apart until they tore. Simple, crude, and very effective. They would have made her watch while they did it, compounding the pain with terror. It's a gut-swooping experience seeing that happen to your body.
On Sharya, the religious police used it a lot. She'd probably need psychosurgery to get over the trauma. The blonde saw where my eyes had gone and offered me a grim nod, as if I'd been an accomplice to the act.
Want to know why your head's still on, huh?
I looked bleakly across the room at him. No, you look like a busy man, but I guess you'll get around to it.
No need, he said casually, enjoying his moment. Old Anemone's Catholic. Third or fourth generation, the girls tell me. Sworn affidavit on disk. Full vow of abstention filed with the Vatican. We take on a lot like that. Real convenient sometimes. You talk too much, Jerry, the woman said.
The blonde eyes flared whitely at her, but whatever retort he was mustering behind the curl of his lip quieted as two men, presumably Deke and Octai, pushed into the tiny room on another wave of junk rhythm from the corridor. My eyes measured Deke and placed him in the same category, muscle, as the pipe wielder, then switched to his companion, who was staring steadily at me. My heart twitched. Octai was the Mongol. Jerry jerked his head in my direction.
"This him?" he asked.
Octai nodded slowly, a savage grin of triumph etched across his broad face. His massive hands were clenching and unclenching at his sides. He was working through an extreme of hate so deep it was choking him. I could see the bump where someone had inexpertly repaired his broken nose with tissue weld, but that didn't seem like enough to warrant the fury I was watching.
All right, Riker. The blonde leaned forward a little. You want to change your story? You want to tell me why you're breaking my balls down here?
He was talking to me. Deke spat into a corner of the room.
I don't know, I said clearly, what the fuck you're talking about. You turned my daughter into a prostitute, and then you killed her. And for that, I'm going to kill you.
I doubt you'll get the chance for that, Jerry said, crouching opposite me and looking at the floor. Your daughter was a stupid, star-struck little cunt who thought she could put a lock on me and...
He stopped and shook his head disbelievingly.
The fuck am I talking to? I see you standing there, and still I'm buying this shit. You're good, Riker. I'll give you that.
He sniffed.
Now, I'm going to ask you one more time, nicely. Maybe see if we can cut a deal. After that, I'm going to send you to see some very sophisticated friends of mine. You understand what I'm saying?
I nodded once, slowly.
Good. So here it comes, Riker. What are you doing in Licktown?
I looked into his face. Small-time punk with delusions of connection. I wasn't going to learn anything here. Who's Riker? The blonde lowered his head again and looked at the floor between my feet. He seemed unhappy about what was going to happen next. Finally, he licked his lips, nodded slightly to himself, and made a brushing gesture across his knees as he stood up.
All right, tough guy, but I want you to remember you had the choice.
He turned to the synthetic woman.
Get him out of here. I want no traces. And tell them he's N-wired to the eyes. They'll get nothing out of him in this sleeve.
The woman nodded and gestured me to my feet with her blaster. She prodded Louise's corpse with the toe of one boot.
And this? Get rid of it. Milo, Deke, go with her.
The pipe wielder shoved his weapon into his waistband and stooped to shoulder the corpse as if it were a bundle of kindling. Deke, close behind, slapped it affectionately on one bruised buttock. The Mongol made a noise in his throat. Jerry glanced across at him with faint distaste.
No, not you. They're going places I don't want you to see. Don't worry. There'll be a disk.
Sure, man,
Deke said over his shoulder.
We'll bring it right back across.
All right, that's enough,
the woman said roughly, moving to face me.
Let's have an understanding here, Riker. You got Norikem. So do I. And this is a high-impact chassis. Lockheed Matoma test pilot specs. You can't damage me with a jack, and I'll be happy to burn your guts out if you even look at me wrong.
They don't care what state you're in, where we're going. That clear, Riker?
My name's not Riker, I said irritably.
Right.
We went through the frosted glass door, into a tiny space that held a makeup table and shower stall, and out onto a corridor parallel to the one at the front of the booths. Here, the lighting was unambiguous. There was no music, and the corridor gave onto larger, partially curtained dressing rooms where young men and women slumped, smoking, or just staring into space like untenanted synthetics. If any of them saw the little procession go past, they gave no indication. Milo went ahead with a corpse. Deke took up position at my back, and the synthetic woman brought up the rear, blaster held casually at her side. My last glimpse of Jerry was a proprietorial figure standing with hands on hips in the corridor behind us. Then Deke cuffed me across the side of the head, and I turned to face the front again. Louise's dangling, mutilated legs preceded me out into a gloomy covered parking area, where a pure black lozenge of air car awaited us. The synthetic cracked the vehicle's trunk open and waved the blaster at me.
Plenty of room. Make yourself comfortable.
I climbed into the trunk and discovered she was right. Then Milo tipped Louise's corpse in with me and slammed the lid down, leaving the two of us in darkness together. I heard the dull clunk of other doors opening and closing elsewhere, and then the whispering of the car's engines and the faint bump as we lifted from the ground. The journey was quick and smoother than a corresponding surface trip would have been. Jerry's friends were driving carefully. You don't want to be pulled down by a bored patrolman for unsignaled lane change when you've got passengers in the trunk. It might almost have been pleasantly womb-like there in the dark, but for the faint stench of feces from the corpse. Louise had voided her bowels during the torture. I spent most of the journey feeling sorry for the girl, and worrying at the Catholic madness like a dog with a bone. The woman's stack was utterly undamaged. Financial considerations aside, she could be brought back to life on the spin of a disc. On Harlan's world, she'd be temporarily re-sleeved for the court hearing, albeit probably in a synthetic, and once the verdict came down, there'd be a victim support supplement from the state added to whatever policy her family already held. 9 cases out of 10, that was enough money to ensure re-sleeving of some sort. Death, where is thy sting? I didn't know if they had VS supplements on Earth. Kristen Ortega's angry monologue 2 nights ago seemed to suggest not, but at least there was the potential to bring this girl back to life. Somewhere on this fucked-up planet, some guru had ordained otherwise, and Louise, alias an enemy, had queued up with how many others to ratify the insanity? Human beings. Never figure them out. The car tilted, and the corpse rolled unpleasantly against me as we spiraled down. Something wet seeped through the leg of my trousers. I could feel myself starting to sweat with the fear. They were going to decant me into some flesh with none of the resistance to pain that my current sleeve had. And while I was imprisoned there, they could do whatever they liked to that sleeve, up to and including physically killing it. And then they would start again, in a fresh body. Or, if they were really sophisticated, they could jack my consciousness into a virtual matrix, similar to the ones used in psychosurgery, and do the whole thing electronically. Subjectively, there'd be no difference. But there, what might take days in the real world could be done in as many minutes. I swallowed hard, using the Nurocam while I still had it to stifle the fear. As gently as I could, I pushed Louise's cold embrace away from my face and tried not to think about the reason she had died. The car touched down and rolled along the ground for a few moments before it stopped. When the trunk cracked open again, all I could see was the roof of another covered parking lot, strung with aluminum bars. They took me out with professional caution, the woman standing well back, Deke and Milo to the sides, giving her a clear field of fire. I clambered awkwardly over Louise and out onto a floor of black concrete. Scanning the gloom covertly, I saw about a dozen other vehicles, nondescript, registration barcodes illegible at this distance. A short ramp at the far end led up to what must be the landing pad. indistinguishable from a million other similar installations. I sighed, and as I straightened up, I felt the damp on my leg again. I glanced down at my clothes. There was a dark stain of something on my thigh.
"So, where are we?" I asked.
"End of the lines where you are," Milo grunted, lifting Louise out. He looked at the woman. "This going to the usual place?"
She nodded, and he set off across the parking lot toward a set of double doors. I was moving to follow when a jerk of the woman's blaster brought me up short.
"Not you. That's the chute. The easy way out. We got people want to talk to you before you get to go down the chute. You go this way."
Deke grinned and produced a small weapon from his back pocket.
"That's right, Mr. Badass Cop. You go this way."
They marched me through another set of doors into a commercial capacity elevator, which, according to the flashing LED display on the wall, sank 24 levels before we stopped. Throughout the ride, Deke and the woman stood in opposite corners of the car, guns leveled. I ignored them and watched the digit counter. When the doors opened, there was a medical team waiting for us with a strap-equipped gurney. My instincts screamed at me to try and jump them, but I held myself immobile while the two pale blue-clad men came forward to hold my arms, and the female medic shot me in the neck with a hypodermic spray. There was an icy sting, a brief rush of cold, and then the corners of my vision disappeared in webbings of gray. The last thing I saw clearly was the incurious face of the medic as she watched me lose consciousness. Chapter 13. I awoke to the sound of the Azon being called somewhere nearby. Poetry turned querulous and metallic in the multiple throats of a mosque's loudspeakers. It was a sound I'd last heard in the skies over Zahiche on Sharia, and it had been shortly followed by the shrill aerial scream of marauder bombs. Above my head, light streamed down through the latticed bars of an ornate window. There was a dull, bloated feeling in my guts that told me my period was due. I sat up on the wooden floor and looked down at myself. They'd sleeved me in a woman's body, young, no more than 20 years old, with copper-sheen skin and a heavy bell of black hair that, when I put my hands to it, felt lank and dirty with the onset of the period. My skin was fairly greasy, and from somewhere I got the idea that I had not bathed in a while. I was clothed in a rough, khaki shirt several sizes too big for my sleeve, and nothing else. Beneath it, my breasts felt swollen and tender. I was barefoot. I got up and went to the window. There was no glass, but it was well above my new head height, so I hauled myself up on the bars and peered out. A sun-drenched landscape of poorly tiled roofs stretched away as far as I could see, forested with listing receptor aerials and ancient satellite dishes. A cluster of minarets speared the horizon off to the left, and an ascending aircraft trailed a line of white vapor somewhere beyond. The air that blew through was hot and humid. My arms were beginning to ache, so I lowered myself back down to the floor and padded across the room to the door. Predictably, it was locked. The Azon stopped. Virtuality. They'd tapped into my memories and come up with this. I'd seen some of the most unpleasant things in a long career of human pain on Sharia. And the Sharian religious police were as popular in interrogation software as Anjan Chandra had been in pilot porn. And now, on this harsh virtual Sharia, they'd sleeved me in a woman. Drunk one night, Sarah had told me, "Women are the race, Tack. No two ways about it. Male is just a mutation with more muscle and half the nerves. Fighting fucking machines." My own cross-sleevings had borne that theory out. To be a woman was a sensory experience beyond the male. Touch and texture ran deeper, an interface with environment that male flesh seemed to seal out instinctively. To a man, skin was a barrier, a protection. To a woman, it was an organ of contact.
That had its disadvantages. In general, and maybe because of this, female pain thresholds ran higher than male, but the menstrual cycle dragged them down to an all-time low once a month. No Nurochem, I checked. No combat conditioning. No reflex of aggression. Nothing. Not even calluses on the young flesh. The door banged open and I jumped. Fresh sweat sprang out on my skin. Two bearded men with eyes of hot jet came into the room. They were both dressed in loose linen for the heat. One held a roll of adhesive tape in his hands, the other a small blowtorch. I flung myself at them, just to unlock the freezing panic reflex and gain some measure of control over the built-in helplessness. The one with the tape fended off my slim arms and backhanded me across the face. It floored me. I lay there, face numb, tasting blood. One of them yanked me back to my feet by an arm. Distantly, I saw the face of the other, the one who had hit me, and tried to focus on him. "So," he said, "we begin." I lunged for his eyes with the nails of my free arm. The envoy training gave me the speed to get there, but I had no control, and I missed. Two of my nails drew blood in his cheek. He flinched and jumped back. "Bitch cunt," he said, lifting a hand to the claw mark and examining the blood on his fingers. "Oh, please," I managed out of the unnumbed side of my mouth. "Do we have to have the script, too? Just because I'm wearing this..." I jammed to a halt. He looked pleased. "Not Irene Elliott, then," he said. "We progress." This time he hit me just under the ribcage, driving all the breath out of my body and paralyzing my lungs. I folded over his arm like a coat and slid off onto the floor, trying to draw breath. All that came out was a faint creaking sound. I twisted on the floorboards while, somewhere high above me, he retrieved the adhesive tape from the other man and unsnapped a quarter-meter length. It made an obscene tearing sound, like skin coming off. Shredding it free with his teeth, he squatted beside me and taped my right wrist to the floor above my head. I thrashed as if galvanized, and it took him a moment to immobilize my other arm long enough to repeat the process. An urge to scream that wasn't mine surfaced, and I fought it down. Pointless. Conserve your strength. The floor was hard and uncomfortable against the soft skin of my elbows. I heard a grating sound and turned my head. The second man was drawing up a pair of stools from the side of the room. While the one who had beaten me taped my legs apart, the spectator sat down on one of the stools, produced a pack of cigarettes, and shook one out. Grinning broadly at me, he put it in his mouth and reached down for the blowtorch. When his companion stepped back to admire his handiwork, he offered him the pack. It was declined. The smoker shrugged, ignited the blowtorch, and tilted his head to light up from it. "You will tell us," he said, gesturing with a cigarette and pluming smoke into the air above me, "everything you know about Jerry's closed quarters and Elizabeth Elliott." The blowtorch hissed and chuckled softly to itself in the quiet room. Sunlight poured in through the high window and brought with it, infinitely faintly, the sounds of a city full of people. They started with my feet. The screaming runs on and on, higher and louder than I ever believed a human throat could render, shredding my hearing, traceries of red streak across my vision. In and in. Jimmy DeSoto staggers into view. Sunjet gone, gory hands plastered to his face. The shrieks peal out from his stumbling figure, and for a moment I can almost believe it's his contamination alarm that's making the noise. I check my own shoulder meter reflexively. Then the half-submerged edge of an intelligible word rises through the agony, and I know it's him. He is standing almost upright, a clear-cut sniper target even in the chaos of the bombardment. I throw myself across the open ground and knock him into the cover of a ruined wall. When I roll him onto his back to see what's happened to his face, he's still screaming.
I pull his hands away from his face by main force, and the raw socket of his left eye gapes up at me in the murk. I can still see fragments of the eye's mucus casing on his fingers.
Jimmy! Jimmy, what the fuck?
The screaming sandpapers on and on. It's taking all my strength to prevent him going back for the other undamaged eye as it wallows in its socket. My spine goes cold as I realize what's happening. Viral strike. I stop yelling at Jimmy and bawl down the line.
Medic! Medic! Stack down! Viral strike!
And the world caves in as I hear my own cries echoed up and down the inn and beachhead. After a while, they leave you alone, curled around your wounds. They always do. It gives you time to think about what they have done to you. More importantly, what else they have not yet done. The fevered imagining of what is still to come is almost as potent a tool in their hands as the heated irons and blades themselves. When you hear them returning, the echo of footsteps induces such fear that you vomit up what little bile you have left in your stomach. Imagine a satellite blow-up of a city on Mosaic, 1 to 10,000 scale. It'll take up most of a decent interior wall, so stand well back. There are certain obvious things you can tell at a glance. Is it a planned development, or did it grow organically, responding to centuries of differing demand? Is it, or was it ever fortified? Does it have a seaboard? Look closer, and you can learn more. Where the major thoroughfares are likely to be, if there's an IP shuttle port, if the city has parks. You can, maybe, if you're a trained cartographer, even tell a little about the movements of the inhabitants, where the desirable areas of town are, what the traffic problems are likely to be, and if the city has suffered any serious bomb damage or riots recently. But there are some things you will never know from that picture. However much you magnify and reel in detail, it can't tell you if crime is generally on the increase or what time the citizens go to bed. It can't tell you if the mayor is planning to tear down the old quarter, if the police are corrupt, or what strange things have been happening at No. 51 Angel Wharf. And the fact that you can break down the mosaic into boxes, move it around, and reassemble it elsewhere makes no difference. Some things you will only ever learn by going into that city and talking to the inhabitants. Digital human storage hasn't made interrogation obsolescent. It's just brought back the basics. A digitized mind is only a snapshot. You don't capture individual thoughts any more than a satellite image captures an individual life. A psychosurgeon can pick out major traumas on an Ellis model and make a few basic guesses about what needs to be done, but in the end, she's still going to have to generate a virtual environment in which to counsel her patient and go in there and do it. Interrogators, whose requirements are so much more specific, have an even worse time. What DHS has done is make it possible to torture a human being to death and then start again. With that option available, hypnotic and drug-based questioning went out the window long ago. It was too easy to provide the necessary chemical or mental counter-conditioning in those for whom this sort of thing was a hazard of their trade. There is no kind of conditioning in the known universe that can prepare you for having your feet burnt off, or your nails torn out, cigarettes stubbed out on your breasts, a heated iron inserted into your vagina, the pain, the humiliation, the damage. Psychodynamics Integrity Training. Introduction. The mind does interesting things under extreme stress. Hallucination, displacement, retreat. Here in the core, you will learn to use them all, not as blind reactions to adversity, but as moves in a game. The red-hot metal sinks into flesh, parting the skin like polyethylene. The pain consumes, but worse is seeing it happen. Your scream, once disbelief, is by now gruesomely familiar in your ears. You know it won't stop them, but you still scream.
begging.
Some fucking game, eh, pal?
Jimmy, grinning up at me from his death. Inanen is still around us, but that can't be. He was still screaming when they took him away. In reality, his face changes abruptly, turns somber.
You keep reality out of this. There's nothing for you there. Stay removed. Have they done her any structural harm?
I wince. Her feet. She can't walk.
Motherfuckers,
he says matter-of-factly. Why don't we just tell them what they want to know? We don't know what they want to know. They're after this guy Riker.
Riker? Who the fuck's he?
I don't know. He shrugs.
So spill about Bancroft. Are you still feeling honor-bound or something?
I think I already spilled. They don't buy it. It's not what they want to hear. He's a fucking amateur's man, meatpackers.
You keep screaming it, they gotta believe it sooner or later.
That isn't the fucking point, Jimmy. When this is over, it doesn't matter who I am. They gotta put a bolt through my stack and sell the body off for spare parts.
Yeah.
Jimmy puts one finger into his empty eye socket and scratches absently at the clotted gore within.
See your point. Well, in a construct situation, what you gotta do is get to the next screen somehow, right?
During the period on Harlan's world, known with typical grim humor as the Unsettlement, guerrillas in the Quellist Black Brigade were surgically implanted with a quarter kilo of enzyme-triggered explosive that would, on demand, turn the surrounding 50 square meters and anything in it to ash. It was a tactic that met with questionable success. The enzyme in question was fury-related, and the conditioning required for arming the device was patchy. There were a number of involuntary detonations. Still, no one ever volunteered to interrogate a member of the Black Brigade. Not after the first one, anyway. Her name... You thought they could do nothing worse. But now the iron is inside you, and they are letting it heat up, slowly, giving you time to think about it. Your pleading is babbled. As I was saying, her name was Iphigenia Demi, Iffy to those of her friends who had not yet been slaughtered by Protectorate forces. Her last words, strapped to the interrogation table downstairs at number 18 Shimatsu Boulevard, are reputed to have been, "That's fucking enough." The explosion brought the entire building down. That's fucking enough. I jackknifed awake, the last of my screams still shrilling inside me, hands scrabbling to cover remembered wounds. Instead, I found young, undamaged flesh beneath crisp linen, a faint rocking motion, and the sound of small waves lapping nearby. Above my head was a sloping wooden ceiling and a porthole through which low-angled sunlight flooded. I sat up in the narrow bunk, and the sheet fell away from my breasts. The coppery upper slopes were smooth and unscarred, the nipples intact. Back to start. Beside the bed was a simple wooden chair with a white t-shirt and canvas trousers folded neatly over it. There were rope sandals on the floor. The tiny cabin held nothing else of interest apart from another bunk, the twin of mine, whose covers were thrown carelessly back, and a door. A bit crude, but the message was clear. I slipped into the clothes and walked out onto the sunlit deck of a small fishing boat.
Aha, the dreamer.
The woman seated in the stern of the skiff clapped her hands together as I emerged. She was about 10 years older than the sleeve I was wearing, and darkly handsome in a suit cut from the same linen as my trousers. There were espadrilles on her bare feet, and wide-lensed sunglasses over her eyes. In her lap was a sketchpad shaded with what looked like a cityscape. As I stood there, she set it aside and stood up to greet me. Her movements were elegant, self-assured. I felt gawky by comparison. I looked over the side at the blue water.
"What is it this time?"
I said with forced lightness.
"Feed me to the sharks."
She laughed, showing perfect teeth.
"No, that won't be necessary at this stage. All I want to do is talk."
I stood loose-limbed, staring at her. "So talk."
"Very well."
The woman folded herself gracefully back into the seat at the stern.
"You have involved yourself in matters that are clearly not your affair, and you have suffered as a result. My interest is, I think, identical to yours. That is, to avoid further unpleasantness."
"My interest is in seeing you die." A small smile.
"Yes, I'm sure it is. Even a virtual death would probably be very satisfying. So, at this point, let me point out that the specifics for this construct include Fifth Dan Shotokan proficiency."
She extended a hand to show me the calluses on her knuckles. I shrugged.
"Moreover, we can always return to the way things were earlier."
She pointed out over the water, and following her arm, I saw the city she had been sketching on the horizon. Squinting into the reflected sunlight, I could make out the minarets. I almost managed to smile at the cheap psychology of it. A boat. The sea. Escape. These boys had bought their programming off the rack.
"I don't want to go back there," I said truthfully. "Good. Then tell us who you are."
I tried not to let the surprise show on my face. The deep cover training awoke, spinning lies. "I thought I had."
"What you have said is somewhat confused, and you curtailed the interrogation by stopping your own heart. You are not Irene Elliott. That much is certain. You do not appear to be Elias Riker, unless he has undergone substantial retraining. You claim a connection with Lorenz Bancroft, and also to be an off-worlder, a member of the Envoy Corps. This is not what we expected."
"I bet it isn't," I muttered.
"We do not wish to be involved in matters that do not concern us."
"You already are involved. You've abducted and tortured an envoy. You got any idea what the Corps will do to you for that? They'll hunt you down and feed your stacks to the EMP. All of you. Then your families. Then your business associates. And then their families. And then anyone else who gets in the way. By the time they've finished, you won't even be a memory. You don't fuck with the Corps and live to write songs about it. They'll eradicate you."
It was a colossal bluff. The Corps and I had not been on speaking terms for at least a decade of my subjective lifetime, and the best part of a century of objective time. But throughout the Protectorate, the envoys were a threat that could be dealt across the table to anyone up to and including a planetary president, with the same assurance that small children in New Pasture threatened with a patchwork man.
"It was my understanding,"
the woman said quietly,
"that the Envoy Corps were banned from operations on Earth unless UN mandated. Perhaps you have as much to lose by revelation as anyone else."
"Mr. Bancroft has an undeclared influence in the UN court, which is more or less common knowledge." Alma Prescott's words came back to me, and I leapt to parry.
"Perhaps you'd like to take that up with Lorenz Bancroft in the UN court," I suggested, folding my arms.
The woman looked at me for a while. The wind ruffled my hair, bringing with it the faint rumble of the city. Finally, she said,
"You are aware we could erase your stack and break down your sleeve into pieces so small there would be no trace. There would effectively be nothing to find."
"They'll find you," I said, with the confidence that a strand of truth in the lie provides.
"You can't hide from the Corps. They'll find you whatever you do. About the only thing you can hope for now is to try to cut a deal."
"What deal?"
she asked woodenly.
In the fractions of a second before I spoke, my mind went into overdrive, measuring the tilt and power of every syllable chosen before it was launched. This was the escape window. There wouldn't be another chance.
There's a biopirate operation moving stolen military custom through the West Coast, I said carefully. They're being fronted by places like Jerry's.
And they called the envoys?
The woman's tone was scornful.
For biopirates? Come on, Riker, is that the best you can do?
I'm not Riker, I snapped. This sleeve's a cover. Look, you're right. 9 times out of 10, this stuff doesn't touch us. The envoys weren't designed to take on criminality at that level, but these people have taken some items they should never have touched. Rapid response diplomatic bioware. Stuff they never should have even seen. Someone's pissed off about it, and I mean at UN Presidium level. So they called us in. The woman frowned.
And the deal?
Well, first of all, you cut me loose, and no one talks about this to anybody. Let's call it a professional misunderstanding. And then you open some channels for me. Name some names. Black clinic like this, the information circulates. That might be worth something to me.
As I said before, we do not wish to involve ourselves.
I came off the rail, letting just enough anger bleed through.
Don't fuck with me, pal. You are involved. Like it or not, you took a big bite out of something that didn't concern you, and now you're going to either chew it or spit it out. What's it going to be?
Silence. Only the sea breeze between us, the faint rocking of the boat.
We will consider this,
the woman said. Something happened to the glinting light on the water. I shifted my gaze out past the woman's shoulder and saw how the brightness unstitched itself from the waves and scribbled into the sky, magnifying. The city whited out as if from a nuclear flash. The edges of the boat faded as if into a sea mist. The woman opposite went with it. It became very quiet. I raised a hand to touch the mist where the parameters of the world ended, and my arm seemed to move in slow motion. There was a static hiss like rain building under the silence. The ends of my fingers turned transparent, then white like the minarets of the city under the flash. I lost the power of motion, and the white crept up my arm. The breath stopped in my throat. My heart paused in mid-beat. I was not. Chapter 14. I woke once more, this time to a rough numbness in the surface of my skin, like the feeling your hands get just after you rinse them clean of detergent or turpentine, but spread throughout the body. Re-entry into a male sleeve. It subsided rapidly as my mind adjusted to the new nervous system, the faint chill of air conditioning on exposed flesh. I was naked. I reached up with my left hand and touched the scar under my eye. They'd put me back. Above me, the ceiling was white and set with powerful spotlights. I propped myself up on my elbows and looked around. Another faint chill, this one internal, coasted through me as I saw that I was in an operating theater. Across the room from where I lay stood a polished steel surgical platform, complete with runnels for the blood and the folded arms of the autosurgeon suspended spider-like above. None of the systems were active, but there were small screens blinking the word "Stand By" on the walls and on a monitor unit beside me. I leaned closer to the display and saw a function checklist scrolling down repeatedly. They had been programming the autosurgeon to take me apart. I was swinging myself off the waiting tray when the door cracked open and the synthetic woman came in with a pair of medics in tow. The particle blaster was stowed at her hip, and she was carrying a recognizable bundle.
Clothes!
She flung them at me with a scowl.
Get dressed!
One of the medics laid a hand on her arm. Procedure calls for...
Yeah!
The woman sneered.
Maybe he'll sue us. You don't think this place is up to a simple D and re. Maybe I'll talk to Ray about moving our business through someone else.
He's not talking about the re-sleeve, I observed, pulling on my trousers. He wants to check for interrogation trauma.
Who asked you?
I shrugged. Suit yourself. Where are we going?
To talk to someone,
she said shortly, and turned back to the medics.
If he is who he says he is, trauma isn't going to be an issue, and if he isn't, he's coming right back here anyway.
I continued dressing as smoothly as I could. Not out of the fire yet, then.
My crossover tunic and jacket were intact, but the bandana was gone, which annoyed me out of all proportion. I'd only bought it a few hours ago. No watch, either. Deciding not to make an issue of it, I press-sealed my boots and stood up. "So who are we going to see?" The woman gave me a sour look.
"Someone who knows enough to check out your shit, and then personally, I think we'll be bringing you back here for orderly dispersal."
"When this is over," I said evenly, "maybe I can persuade one of our squads to pay you a visit. In your real sleeve, that is. They'll want to thank you for your support." The blaster came out of its sheath with a soft strop and was under my chin. I barely saw it happen. My recently re-sleeved senses scrabbled for a reaction, eons too late. The synthetic woman leaned close to the side of my face.
"Don't you ever threaten me, you piece of shit," she said softly. "You got these clowns scared. They're anchored in place, and they think you're carrying the weight to sink them. That doesn't work with me. Got it?"
I looked at her out of the corner of my eye, the best I could manage, with my head jammed up by the gun. "Got it," I said.
"Good,"
she breathed, and removed the blaster.
"You check out with Ray, I'll line up and apologize with everybody else. But until then, you're just another potential wipeout gibbering for your stack."
We went at a rapid pace down corridors that I tried to memorize, and into an elevator identical to the one that had delivered me to the clinic. I counted the floors off again, and when we stepped out into the parking area, my eyes jerked involuntarily to the door that they had taken Louise through. My recollections of time during the torture were hazy. The envoy conditioning was deliberately curtaining off the experience to avert the trauma. But even if it had gone on a couple of days, that was about 10 minutes real time. I'd probably only been in the clinic an hour or two maximum, and Louise's body might still be waiting for the knife behind that door, her mind still stacked.
"Get in the car,"
the woman said laconically. This time my ride was a larger, more elegant machine, reminiscent of Bancroft's limousine. There was already a driver in the forward cabin, liveried and shaven-headed with the barcode of his employer printed above his left ear. I'd seen quite a few of these on the streets of Bay City, and wondered why anyone would submit to it. On Harlan's world, no one outside the military would be seen dead with authorization stripes. It was too close to the serfdom of the settlement years for comfort. A second man stood by the rear cabin door, an ugly-looking machine pistol dangling negligently from his hand. He too had the shaven skull and the barcode. I looked hard at it as I passed him and got into the rear cabin. The synthetic woman leaned down to talk to the chauffeur, and I cranked up the Neurochem to eavesdrop.
"Head in the clouds. I want to be there before midnight."
"No problem. Coastal's running light tonight, and..."
One of the medics slammed the door shut on me, and the solid clunk at max amplification nearly blew my eardrums. I sat in silence, recovering, until the woman and the machine pistolier opened the doors on either side and climbed in next to me.
"Close your eyes,"
the woman said, producing my bandana.
"I'm going to blindfold you for a few minutes. If we do let you go, these guys aren't going to want you knowing where to find them."
I looked around at the windows. "These look polarized to me anyway."
"Yeah, but no telling how good that Neurochem is, huh? Now hold still."
She knotted the red cloth with practiced efficiency and spread it a little to cover my whole field of vision. I settled back in the seat.
"Couple of minutes. You just sit quiet and no peeking. I'll tell you when."
The car boosted up and presumably out because I heard the drumming of rain against the bodywork. There was a faint smell of leather from the upholstery, which beat the odor of feces on the inbound journey, and the seat I was in molded itself supportively to my form. I seemed to have moved up in the order of things.
"Strictly temporary, man."
I smiled faintly as Jimmy's voice echoed in the back of my skull. He was right. A couple of things were clear about whoever we were going to see. This was someone who didn't want to come to the clinic, who didn't even want to be seen near it. That bespoke respectability, and with it, power. The power to access off-world data. Pretty soon, they were going to know that the Envoy Corps was an empty threat. And very shortly after that, I was going to be dead. Really dead.
Kinda dictates the action, pal.
Thanks, Jimmy. After a few minutes, the woman told me to take off the blindfold. I pushed it up onto my forehead and retied it there in its customary position. At my side, the muscle with the machine pistol smirked. I gave him a curious look.
Something funny?
Yeah.
The woman spoke without turning her gaze from the city lights beyond the window.
You look like a fucking idiot.
Not where I come from. She turned to look at me pityingly.
You aren't where you come from. You're on Earth. Try behaving like it.
I looked from one to the other of them. The pistolier still smirking, the synthetic with the expression of polite contempt, then shrugged and reached up with both hands to untie the bandana. The woman went back to watching the lights of the city sink below us. The rain seemed to have stopped. I chopped down savagely from head height, left and right. My left fist jarred into the pistolier's temple with enough force to break the bone, and he slumped sideways with a single grunt. He never even saw the blow coming. My right arm was still in motion. The synthetic whipped around, probably faster than I could have struck, but she misread me. Her arm was raised to block and cover her head, and I was under the guard, reaching. My hand closed on the blaster at her belt, knocked out the safety, and triggered it. The beam seethed into life, cutting downward, and a large quantity of the woman's right leg burst open in wet ropes of flesh before the blowback circuits cut the blast. She howled, a cry more of rage than of pain, and I dragged the muzzle of the weapon up, triggering another blast diagonally across her body. The blaster carved a channel a hand-breadth wide right through her and into the seat behind. Blood exploded across the cabin. The blaster cut out again, and the cabin went suddenly dim as the flaring of the beam weapon stopped. Beside me, the synthetic woman bubbled and sighed, and then the section of her torso that the head was attached to sagged away from the left side of the body. Her forehead came to rest against the window she had been looking out of. It looked oddly as if she was cooling her brow on the rain-streaked glass. The rest of the body sat stiffly upright. The massive sloping wound cauterized clean by the beam. The mingled stink of cooked meat and fried synthetic components were everywhere.
Trap! Trap!
It was the chauffeur's intercom squawking. I wiped blood out of my eyes and looked at the screen set in the forward bulkhead.
"She's dead," I told the shocked face, and held up the blaster. "They're both dead, and you're next, if you don't get us on the ground right now."
The chauffeur rallied.
"We're 500 meters above the bay, friend, and I'm flying this car. What do you propose doing about that?"
I selected a midpoint on the wall between the two cabins, knocked out the blowback cutout on the blaster, and shielded my face with one hand.
"Hey, what are you—"
I fired through into the driver's compartment on tight focus. The beam punched a molten hole about a centimeter wide, and for a moment it rained sparks backwards into the cabin as the armoring beneath the plastic resisted. Then the sparks died as the beam broke through, and I heard something electrical short out in the forward compartment. I stopped firing.
"The next one goes right through your seat," I promised. "I've got friends who'll re-sleeve me when they fish us out of the bay. You I'll carve into stakes right through this fucking wall, and even if I miss your stack, they'll have a hard time finding which part of you it's inside. Now fucking get me on the ground."
The limousine banked abruptly to one side, losing altitude. I sat back a little amidst the carnage and cleaned more blood off my face with one sleeve.
"That's good," I said more calmly. "Now set me down near Mission Street, and if you're thinking about signaling for help, think about this. If there's a firefight, you die first. Got it? You die first. I'm talking about real death. I'll make sure I burn out your stack if it's the last thing I do before they take me down."
His face looked back at me on the screen, pale. Scared,
but not scared enough. Or maybe scared of someone else. Anyone who barcodes their employees isn't likely to be the forgiving type, and the reflex of long-held obedience through hierarchy is usually enough to overcome fear of a combat death. That's how you fight wars, after all, with soldiers who are more afraid of stepping out of line than they are of dying on the battlefield. I used to be like that myself.
How about this? I offered rapidly. You violate traffic protocol, putting us down. The SEA turn up, bust you, and hold you. You say nothing. I'm gone, and they've got nothing on you outside of a traffic misdemeanor. Your story is you're just the driver. Your passengers had a little disagreement in the back seat, and then I hijacked you to the ground. Meanwhile, whoever you work for bails you out rapido, and you pick up a bonus for not cracking in virtual holding.
I watched the screen. His expression wavered, and he swallowed hard. Enough carrot. Time for the stick. I locked the blowback circuit on again, lifted the blaster so we could see it, and fitted it to the nape of Trepp's neck.
I'd say you're getting a bargain.
At point-blank range, the blaster beam vaporized spine, stack, and everything around it. I turned back to the screen.
Your call.
The driver's face convulsed, and the limo started to lose height raggedly. I watched the flow of traffic through the window, then leaned forward and tapped on the screen.
Don't forget that violation, will you?
He gulped and nodded. The limo dropped vertically through stacked lanes of traffic and bumped hard along the ground, to a chorus of furious collision alert screeches from the vehicles around us. Through the window, I recognized the street I'd cruised with Curtis the night before. Our pace slowed somewhat.
Crack the near side door, I said,
tucking the blaster under my jacket. Another jerky nod, and the door in question clunked open, then hung ajar. I swiveled, kicked it wide, and heard police sirens wailing somewhere above us. My eyes met the driver's on the screen for a moment, and I grinned.
Wise man,
I said, and threw myself out of the coasting vehicle. The pavement hit me in the shoulder and back as I rolled amidst startled cries from passing pedestrians. I rolled twice, hit hard against a stone frontage, and climbed cautiously to my feet. A passing couple stared at me, and I skinned my teeth in a smile that made them hurry on, finding interest in other shop fronts. A stale blast of displaced air washed over me as a traffic cop's cruiser dropped in the wake of the offending limo. I stayed where I was, giving back the diminishing handful of curious looks from passerby who had seen my unorthodox arrival. Interest in me was waning in any case. One by one the stares slipped away, drawn by the flashing lights of the police cruiser, now hovering menacingly above and behind the stationary limo.
"Turn off your engines and remain where you are,"
the airborne speaker system crackled. A crowd started to knot up as people hurried past me, jostling and trying to see what was going on. I leaned back on the frontage, checking myself for damage from the jump. By the feel of the fading numbness in my shoulder and across my back, I'd done it right this time.
"Raise your hands above your head and step away from your vehicle,"
came the metallic voice of the traffic cop. Over the bobbing heads of the spectators, I made out the driver, easing himself out of the limo in the recommended posture. He looked relieved to be alive. For a moment, I caught myself wondering why that kind of standoff wasn't more popular in the circles I moved in. Just too many death wishes all around, I guess. I backstepped a few meters in the mix of the crowd, then turned and slipped away into the brightly lit anonymity of the Bay City night.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.